Hello! Welcome to the Rotten Horror Picture Show, the horror movie podcast where we talk about films off the Rotten Tomatoes 200 Best Horror Movies of All Time list. My name is Clay. With me, as always, is Amanda. How are you doing, Amanda?
I'm doing well. I'm here in my full Red Death outfit.
Mm-hmm. Oh, we both are, actually.
Ready
kinda.
To go. Yeah, sort of.
I didn't wear red pants, though.
I should have.
Nice hat.
Thanks.
This is a special occasion because, first of all, it is the 100th anniversary year of the movie that we're talking about today.
Mm-hmm.
And second of all, we actually managed to do it.
Yay!
in the right time. Just under the wire.
We're cutting it quite close.
Yes. We are talking about today the 1925 silent film, The Phantom of the Opera.
Mm-hmm. With cue organ music.
You know, I'm going to say right up off the bat here.
Yes.
I don't have a problem with silent movies.
Uh-oh.
I like them.
But
I think it really, we talked about this with Nosferatu.
Mm-hmm.
It really lives or dies on whatever music they put to this.
Yes.
And the music in this movie sucks.
Well,
like
I would argue there are some notable moments.
So to be fair, the notes being played aren't necessarily the thing that bothers me.
Mm.
What bothers me is there's a certain kind of film music that I can't stand because it always sounds cheap to me.
And sounds like one of those organ grinders.
No,
with his monkey outside.
No, that would be fine.
Mm.
It's when you try to do that, but it's clearly one guy on a keyboard. It's when you're using a synthesizer keyboard to try and emulate real instruments.
Yep.
It just sounds so fake.
Fair.
And so it just sounds cheap to me.
Yeah.
At least the version we watched, the one on Shudder, that's the music that was along. That's the other thing too, is I think you can probably watch five different versions of this with five different music tracks. I don't know if there is a original track.
Yeah, it doesn't sound like there's really a definitive version of this movie.
Which is too bad.
Yeah. I would agree.
Nosferatu, I understand, because that went through a lot of chicanery.
Sounds like this one did too.
Shenanigans.
Mm-hmm.
But at least this one was put out by Universal Studios, which you would think they would have their shit together. But
nope.
Maybe not.
You would think. Wrong.
Yeah. There's a show on Netflix right now.
Okay.
Yeah. Stay with me. Can't remember the name of it.
Great anecdote.
Good start.
Great anecdote at the top of the episode.
So my one of my favorite shows, unironically,
that you can't remember the name of,
is The Foods That Made America.
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah.
And it presents food history about American food brands, run through an amazing lens of very capital D dramatic reenactment.
Mm-hmm.
There is a show on Netflix, which is a similar vein about the pioneers of the movie business.
Okay.
And Carl Laemmle, the founder of Universal Studios, did a lot more to just create the general movie-going
experience.
Yeah, pretty much. Like, more than the other guys, at least, because he invented renting movies, basically.
Huh.
He also invented pirating them.
Hey.
So
that's how you get rich, Clay.
Yeah, clearly.
Play both sides of the equation.
Uh-huh. You invent pirating, and then once you get to a position of power, you then look down on people who then pirate you.
Yes.
That's how it works.
Yeah.
Anyway, we're talking about The Phantom of the Opera from Universal Studios. It has it is number 93 currently on our list. It has a 90% Rotten Tomatoes score with an 84% audience score. You had seen this before, right?
Yes. Yes. This is one of those ones where I'm like 99% sure the first time I saw it was in the extraordinarily half-assed film club that we had at my high school for like half of my senior year that really went nowhere. Where we watched
the senior year went nowhere, or the film class went nowhere?
That probably both.
Okay.
Yeah. No, it was film club.
Oh, film club.
This is for nerds
who
are opting into doing more work.
Mm-hmm.
But we watched a bunch of early kind of, you know, the Chien Andalou and the Cabinet of Dr. Caligari and things like that.
Movies you can talk about with literally nobody else.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Have you ever seen that?
Clearly, we had like one pretentious young teacher who was like, I will teach the youth.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Have you ever seen that Portlandia skit about renting Netflix and he's got the he can't go out because he has to watch the cabinet of Dr. Calico.
Yeah. Yeah. So he's like trapped in his house forever. Yes. Yeah. Yeah. That is how I felt. But yeah, I'm pretty sure I saw it then. Which is kind of funny. This, like, I have like a vivid memory of being really resistant to this movie when I first watched it,
mm-hmm.
because I was also, you'll all be shocked to hear if I haven't mentioned this already, a theater nerd.
Mm.
Like, I was one of the theater kids, and it was around.
I don't think I knew that.
Really?
I knew you were an, I knew you did dance.
Yep.
I knew that you read books.
Yeah. Yep.
I don't think I knew you were a theater kid.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
Just solid right down the middle on that bingo card.
Absolute loser. Yeah. So it was around a time though when at least in my little microcosm, the musical was having like a very big resurgence. Mm-hmm. I don't know if it had just gotten back on Broadway or if it had, I don't know.
Maybe it was around the time the movie came out.
Maybe. Yeah. I just remember like the most insufferable people I knew getting really obsessed with the musical version of this, and therefore I was like, no, I am not interested.
Fair. That's probably the same reaction I would have had.
And then I saw the movie and was like, actually, this is pretty badass.
This movie?
Yeah.
Okay.
This movie.
The one we're talking about.
Yes.
Gotcha. Yeah, I had, I think I might have kind of gone through a reverse version of that.
So where you were really into the musical.
No. So what's funny
Got him.
I don't particularly like musicals.
Mm-hmm.
And I lived in New York for 4 years. Never went to a Broadway show.
You absolute Philistine.
I know. Well, it's different. So I was in Brooklyn at school.
Oh my God.
Like, you live
you poor
the
thing.
Same place. When people say, what's going on in Boston? Do you have an answer for them?
Yeah.
No, you don't, because you never go there.
No, I just went and saw a Rachel Roisch exhibit at the MFA a week ago.
Don't make up words. Don't make up words. Anyway, so living in Brooklyn.
She's an amazing Dutch still life painter.
They've been dead for 500 years, okay?
That doesn't. But, all right, go on.
You know, it's just not something. I wasn't there. Sure. I was in that part of my life where it's like I didn't want to do the cliche stuff.
Yeah.
I didn't go up the Empire State Building. I didn't do any of that touristy shit.
Yeah, that's fair.
I just did the Empire State Building last year. It was actually very fun.
Yeah, it is fun.
And so I never went to a Broadway show. My girlfriend and I were talking, and she was appalled, as you were. And I was like, well, the only one I've ever wanted to go see was Phantom of the Opera.
Hmm.
And she said, okay, we're going to go see Phantom of the Opera. And then maybe like 2 months later, they announced it was closing.
Yeah.
So just got to wait till it comes back, because it will.
It will.
It always does.
It will.
But anyway, as far as this movie goes, I think I watched this probably when I was really getting into digging into this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I probably watched this in the same chunk of time that I watched Cabinet of Dr. Caligari, Nosferatu, mm-hmm. or, you know, The Man Who Laughs.
Mm.
And I went out of my way to buy this on DVD.
Oh, wow.
Even though this is like, for some reason, this has scarred me. Because the DVD was a 2-disc DVD.
Mm-hmm.
And it was expensive.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know why I bought it.
Because
I bought it and I was like, oh, yeah, I got to get this one. And I think I got home and I was like, I'm never going to watch this again. Not that I didn't like it, but it was like the like having it in my library meant more than actually watching the movie.
Yeah, absolutely. I have a bunch of books like that too.
Yeah. I try not to be so the problem now is I've gone so completely off the rails as far as buying movies go. Like when I was in this era of my life,
mm-hmm.
I was the movies I was picking were very specific. Like like, okay, my entire personality is this one shelf.
Right.
So how do I impress people with this one shelf?
Right. You're trying to like curate a collection, but it's also very much for some like outward facing idea of what kind of person you are. Yeah.
Right. It's for someone to look at the movies on your shelf and go, ooh, what's Don't Look Now? And I'm like, well, how much time do you have?
What an interesting and well-educated man.
Yes. I'm sorry, I don't have Old School. I'm sorry, I don't have that. Actually, I do have my old school. But yeah, I watched this and I think I watched it and I liked it. Mm-hmm. And then I bought the DVD and never really watched it ever again.
Yeah.
I think, did I also see this? This might have been one of the ones I saw on Halloween in New York at the cathedral.
See, that's a good choice.
That's the way to see it.
Yeah.
I think watching some of these silent movies at home by yourself, unless you're doing it academically, not really that rewarding. But
yeah,
I could be wrong, to each their own.
Mm.
But I do like it. I hadn't watched it in a while
yeah.
since this. And yeah, it'll be fun to talk about. So
yes.
We're going to take a quick break. There's no trailer I can really play for this silent film.
Is it just going to be a bunch of organ music?
No, I have an idea. Okay. If I could find the video, I'll pop it in. If not, it'll just be organ music or something. Anyway, we'll be right back.
I am the Phantom. My real name is Jerry. I'm really lonely. I'd love to have a girlfriend. Something happened to my face. That's why I wear a scary mask. And I think I'd take it off, but I haven't read the rest of the script, so I don't know. Blah, 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 blah. Music of the
marvelous. Thank you, dude. God bless you.
I'll get better.
Oh, it was wonderful. Better. Will
Ferrell, ladies and gentlemen. Okay, The Phantom of the Opera from 1925, directed by Rupert Julian, written by, well, it's adapted from the novel by Gaston Leroux and apparently 8 uncredited writers on IMDb.
Ouch.
There are 8 other people listed as having contributed. I guess, I don't know, I guess it was kind of weird back then because... Like, if you look at the credits, there's a writer who just wrote the title cards.
Oh,
and
yeah.
So I think there's like a person who staged the production. I don't know. It's
okay.
Back when it was much more of the Wild West in terms of how they credited the stuff.
All right, that makes more sense.
Starring Lon Chaney, Mary Philbin, Norman Carey, Arthur Edmund Carulli. I don't know how to say that. Mary Fabian and Virginia Pearson. Amanda, what happens in The Phantom of the Opera?
A mad, disfigured composer seeks love with a lovely young opera singer.
Well, that just sounds charming as hell.
That is how IMDb sees this movie.
Excellent.
A romantic comedy about star-crossed lovers.
Anyone who's ever had been self-conscious or had self-esteem issues, we are all Eric.
Well, Clay, some things you'll find in the 1925 version of The Phantom of the Opera include a multi-floor basement big enough to house a horse, a 3-floor M.C. Escher-style ramp, a boat, a whole black lake, and an apartment bigger than my house.
Yeah, it's pretty cool.
Yeah.
It's pretty huge.
It's amazing.
It is described in the opening title as the sanctuary of song lovers. The Paris Opera House, rising nobly over medieval torture chambers, hidden dungeons, long forgotten.
Fucking metal, man. I love it.
And it sure is. you could fit all of those things in there.
Yeah.
I have a lot of questions.
We'll get to them later. You will also find a ghost with lovely penmanship.
Yeah. I'm
threatening
really,
letters with some gorgeous calligraphy.
He's got a whole stationery set.
Yeah.
Because he's got envelopes that are like black lined.
Erudite gentleman.
Yeah. I find it very funny that I don't really know what they think he is because they kind of think he's a guy, but then they kind of say he's a ghost and then he's leaving letters for people. So that they are just taking seriously.
Yes. So. Yeah. There's never a question of, is this a prank?
Yeah.
Kind of immediately like, oh no, that guy, because he has his very distinctive stationery.
That's true.
So they know it's him.
Yeah.
You'll also find extended sequences of someone singing in a movie with no sound.
Yeah. Probably could have cut some of those down a little bit.
Yeah, I think that might have been a little bit of a early padding the runtime.
Yeah, it's not a long movie.
It's not a long movie.
And it's so the sequence where that happens is the chandelier sequence.
Yeah.
Right?
There's one after that, too, at some point as well. Yeah, but the chandelier sequence is
The main one where they're, like, focusing on the person singing for a while.
Yes, and they keep cutting back to the crowd and then back to the singer.
Yeah, and I can see, obviously, mm-hmm. this is the early days. They haven't quite figured all this stuff out yet.
Mm-hmm.
I could see using that to visually build tension to the dropping of the thing,
mm-hmm.
but they're not really doing that. It's just sort of like, here's a lady.
Yep.
Singing
wouldn't,
yep. I don't know.
That's how movies used to be. Speaking of which, you'll also find Death by Decor.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Multiple men who cannot take a hint or mixed signals.
I would
say. Depending on whose perspective you would like to inhabit.
Little column A, little column B there, which I think we will talk about.
They are both very present.
Uh-huh.
The OG masked maniac.
Yeah, I guess that's true.
Right? As far as I could be wrong. This is just my own personal assertion,
guess.
But I can't think of a...
Yeah, at least in movies.
Yeah?
Yeah. Good for him.
Good for him. He has a long lineage to follow. You'll also find the Punjab lasso.
Yes.
Can you explain to me, Clay, how one ties a Punjab lasso?
I cannot. Because I think, do they explain it in the movie? Because I might have dozed off at that point.
No, they just like
but
say it.
I can tell you how to defend against it, which is to walk with your hand up by your head.
But you can't just do it like a hand up. You've got to have like jaunty fingers.
Yes.
Yeah, you've got to be stylish.
To be like antenna up sensing for the deadly Punjab.
Like you're about to start dancing a Bob Fosse routine or something.
Yes, but then just kind of walk like a marionette.
Yeah. You'll also find a coffin bed and a boat bed.
You know, it's his and hers.
Yeah.
It's the 1800s France version of having a race car bed, which I have respect for.
Yeah, I get it. It keeps you reminded that of that other dreamless sleep that cures all ills.
Mescaline.
Death.
I think mescaline might be a
death
hallucinogenic. I've never done drugs. I don't know.
Oh, my God.
Quaaludes. That's what I was looking for.
Black tie snorkeling.
Yeah. So this watch, it was the first time that I really kind of appreciated how... It's one of the great things about Chaney's performance in that he is so well dressed.
Yes.
And he holds himself.
Yes.
So his posture is impeccable.
Mm-hmm.
And the point where I noticed this is when he is walking in full tuxedo.
Yes.
Into a river with a gigantic snorkel.
Yeah. Giant piece of bamboo.
To go and sneak up on someone.
Snorkel.
Yeah.
Yes.
It was really one of those things where I'm like, wow, what a performance. And also, there wasn't a better way they could have staged this.
I had no complaints. I think it was perfect. You'll also find the most amazing doorbell I've ever seen.
Yeah. Is the cat one?
Yeah.
Every
time somebody comes down the stairs, it just goes up and down and like clangs. I don't know. You can't hear it because it's a silent movie, but I would love that doorbell.
Just like every time I go to a Chinese or food restaurant, they get one of those that does that. Does that thing have a name?
It does, but I don't know it.
Racist.
What?
Hmm?
Would you like to have that fight?
No.
You will also find classic Angry Mob.
Yeah. I think Hunchback comes out before this.
Oh, I don't know.
But I was going to say this might be the first of the Universal Angry Villagers.
Yeah. Are they villagers if
not
it's
really.
Paris?
It's Paris.
That's kind of why I went with Mob, because I also wanted to call them Angry Villagers. But then I was like, I don't think Paris counts as a village.
Well, listen. Once you pull out some pitchforks and torches,
you become a villager. It's more of a state of mind than an actual defined frame of being.
Yeah. To be fair, I haven't seen Hunchback.
Mm.
So I don't know if there are torch-bearing mob. Mm. I'm going to say there probably is.
Probably.
But it also takes place in Paris, so what's going on there? A lot of angry people there.
I mean, home of the revolution, right?
At least one.
Multiple.
Yeah.
And last, but definitely not least, the old fake hand grenade.
I do remember the first time I watched this thinking, what the hell is he doing? Like, it's such an interesting choice to have him, like, backed into a corner, mm-hmm. pretend to have some sort of weapon, uh-huh. and then just go, ah, I'm fooling.
Yeah.
So.
Yes.
Phantom of the Opera, 1925.
Yes.
I think we talked about this a bit when we did Nosferatu. Mm-hmm. The modern versions of the modern restorations of these all have the original film tinting mm-hmm. on them, so it's not just straight black and white. I don't think I like it. Like, I get used to it
yeah.
as the movie goes.
Yeah.
But I find it less scary.
Hmm.
This might be the same conversation we had on that, but it's like Nosferatu. It is one where I like, this should be in black and white.
Yeah, yeah. I feel a little more mixed about this one.
Yeah.
I think, because I love the scene when he shows up in the Red Death outfit.
That's the thing.
Yeah. Like, when he's both in the ball and then outside on the rooftop with the wind blowing and billowing that red cloak around mm-hmm. him. It's so great. Like, that's one of my favorite sequences yeah. in this movie. And I get what you mean, though, with the other color tinting where it's just like the whole scene is tinted like a light purple
right.
or like an orange yeah. and you just kind of for some reason that scene is that color and then you move on and maybe the next scene's another color
mm-hmm. like it's the opening shot of this I actually like the opening shot with the
yeah.
tinting because it's this really blood red
yeah
that
they
I feel like you don't usually get
red
that color
in this one.
Yeah
yeah
and it's a very very heavily shadow of, mm-hmm. of someone like walking through the bowels of the opera house
yes
and it's very ominous whereas I just don't once they get into those colors that are like well it's daytime so everything should be I don't know orange oh it's nighttime
right,
I guess
right.
it should be turquoise I don't
yeah,
know
yeah kind of bluish
yeah nothing yeah. nothing changes I guess but that kind of bothers me I wish there was more. For a movie as operatic mm-hmm. as this, I wish there were like bigger swings, more in line with the red from the beginning.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But yeah, overall, the Red Death sequence, I think was something that for a long time was missing from the movie.
Oh, really?
I think. I think one of the things that made the DVD release that I very proudly bought and never watched so important was that the restoration had put it back in.
Oh, okay.
I could be making this up, but so I think that probably having that in there makes the rest mm-hmm. of the tinting make more sense, I
yeah.
think.
Yeah.
I don't know. It's just one of those things where when I picture Lon Chaney's Phantom, I picture black and white. I don't picture
yeah.
like purple.
I wonder if that some of that is like that's usually the images we saw of it first. Like
I'm
the
sure
still,
it is. Yeah.
The stills of it are probably mostly reproduced in black and white,
mm-hmm.
or at least used to be. I don't know anymore.
And this was another movie similar to Nosferatu and like Night of the Living Dead, where I believe there was a copyright issue.
Mm.
So. You could find this literally everywhere.
Yeah.
And that version was always just straight black and white.
Yeah.
So I think that probably ended up being the most familiar version
yeah.
was the black and white version.
Yeah, the one that other shows were cutting to in their montages and,
exactly.
and things like
yeah.
that. Yeah.
Elvira never cut to turquoise.
Yeah. She wouldn't dare.
But yeah, I think one of the most interesting things about this movie for me is this, even though this is on the list of the 200 best horror movies of all time,
mm-hmm.
this movie exists before that term exists.
Yeah.
So this was like a big production
yeah.
for Universal. This was the adaptation of a literary novel.
Mm-hmm.
This was not a schlocky,
yeah.
what Phantom of the Opera movies turn into,
yeah.
which is... makes me that much more sad that I didn't put the Robert Englund version on our remakes and reboots list because, boy, you want to see the polar opposite of this is that one. Anyway, we'll get there eventually. Hmm. And so, like, this is a big, lavish production that has these massive sets.
Yeah.
The Opera House set, I think they kept the set for like 70 years or something.
Yeah, or at least 50 years of it.
And I think there's still some left.
Yeah.
A whole bunch. I think The Sixth Sense shot on the same stage as this.
Oh, wow.
So they were using the stage up until then. Yeah. And it's just...
also, like, how many extras do you think are in this movie?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I mean...
Like, those opera scenes with people, like, running out after the chandelier. Like, it's got to be at least a couple hundred people.
Oh, definitely. Yeah. And even one of my favorite... Probably my favorite detail is... I love the ballerinas.
Yes.
Who all move like a flock
of
birds.
I love them too. And I have such an affection for the ballerinas. Yeah.
And I just keep thinking, like, you know, 20, 15 years later, they make this movie, there's like three of them.
Right.
You know, and it's not, they're not doing anything interesting.
And in this, there's like 12.
Yeah.
At least.
There's a whole bunch of them just moving around. And it's, you can feel the money they're putting on the screen for something that... Up until the musical, I don't think people necessarily regard it. But between this movie and the musical, Phantom of the Opera kind of loses its literary luster and turns into, okay, it's another monster movie.
I think that perception is really interesting because I agree with you. My read is also that it used to be kind of treated as, it's like The Mummy or The Invisible Man or, Frankenstein.
Especially once those other franchises started, it's like, oh, well, this guy's a monster.
Yeah, look
Throw
at
him.
Him
in there.
Yeah. But I feel like it's not treated that way anymore.
I think that's probably mostly the musicals.
Yeah.
Would you agree?
Yeah, I guess so. Yeah. It's just so interesting to me that... I think people are aware that this was a movie before it was a musical, but maybe not. I don't know. It's just, I find that very fascinating that this is the one that sort of kicked it all off, right? Mm-hmm. And then it also has somehow become exempt from the popular understanding of these old Universal monster movies as, like, just kind of schlock.
Mm-hmm.
This one has now, in modern times, somehow been separated out.
Yeah.
As like, no, this is actually like, oh, this is like highfalutin.
Well, if Andrew Lloyd Webber wrote a Dracula musical.
Yeah. Maybe we'd be there.
Maybe if Jim Steinman's vampire musical ever made it to. Did you know that a lot of songs written for Meatloaf were reused from a Dracula, not Dracula, it's just a vampire-based musical written by Jim Steinman, the guy who wrote all the songs.
I did not know that, but now that you say it. It makes sense.
Yeah, I kind of wish it actually happened. Yeah. But he also wrote a Batman musical, I think. I might be mixing my stories up, but I'm pretty sure he wrote a Batman musical.
I don't think the Batman songs were given to Meatloaf, though.
They were.
Were they really?
Yeah, I believe they were. They were slightly reworked, and a couple of them ended up on Meatloaf albums.
Amazing.
I think it's looking at the trajectory for these movies is so fascinating because you've got Hunchback in 1923, also starring Lon Chaney, torturing himself for our enjoyment.
Jeez.
Also a literary adaptation.
Yep.
Masquerading as a monster movie or vice versa. Then you get this in 25. And then the one that bridges the gap between literary highfalutinness and cheap monster movie. Is Dracula.
Of course.
Which Carl Laemmle Jr. Had to kind of talk his dad into doing.
Yep.
But it's really fascinating to see that. It's like, okay, well, it's technically Dracula ends up being both. Because it is, it's based on a very widely known and well-recognized novel.
Yep.
But it is also a schlocky monster movie.
Yes.
And that kind of feeds this into the next... Well, I guess it's still going after this point. Yeah. But that's the creation of the horror movie, at least in America.
Yeah. Yeah, isn't this also, don't they claim this movie is kind of the one that kicked off horror specifically in America?
I think so.
Right? Because I feel like maybe this was on like the last drive-in with Joe Bob Briggs or something, that they were talking about how prior to this, anything that you would kind of think of as horror wasn't done in the U.S. It was a European production.
Yeah.
And so this was the first one that it was like, oh, an American monster movie.
Yeah. And there wasn't even a word for it. Like, yeah, they weren't called horror movies. I don't know what you would call them.
A melodrama?
But, yeah.
I don't know.
I'm not like, I think the X factor here is Chaney.
Yeah.
Because you can do this movie with someone who's not quite as insane as he was. And it just sort of, yeah, okay, we've adapted this novel.
Yeah.
Look at all the money we spent. Fine. But you've got this weird sadomasochist who spent his entire life deforming himself at the center of it, making this into a monster movie.
Yeah. Yeah, not just an ugly guy.
Right.
It's not like they just gave him like a bad haircut. I mean, they did give him a bad haircut. But it's not like they took a movie star and just gave him a bad haircut and like,
yeah,
I don't know, a fake scar on his face or something.
That's the thing, too. I would be really curious to see what they would do if it wasn't Chaney, because that whole look is all him.
Right.
Like, he developed that whole thing. He all of his movies, he developed the looks, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah.
But, you know, if you take him out of the equation and this is just a studio production.
Yeah.
What the hell does the Phantom look like?
And he's also, like, this feels obvious to say, but he's also a good actor.
Yeah.
Like, especially, I think, for this time period and this style of movie where it is, you know, silent. And so you have to do so much more with your facial expressions and your physicality, your body language. And I think he does such an amazing job of giving the character of the Phantom a character.
Oh, yeah.
You know, he's not just like a raving maniac in the basement. He is also that, but he's
once he takes the mask off, kind of.
Yeah. But I like the idea that you can tell from how Chaney plays it that this character thinks of himself as an educated upper class gentleman.
Yeah, it's like I was saying, the way he holds himself. Yep. It's very, he's never really like hunched over in the corner or anything. He's always standing very upright. And
the way he, when he comes through the ball, the masquerade ball, and the way he sort of just kind of backhands people away from him and has this very like proper stance in the whole outfit. And he is ugly, but he's vain.
Yeah.
He's so vain.
Like Dr. Doom.
Yeah. He's so concerned with his appearance and the ways he can make up for his face. Mm-hmm. So his clothes are always perfect and he's always extremely well-dressed. And he kind of creates this mask that's supposed to look like a beautiful face, right? It's this like perfect porcelain face that he gives himself. And he's so particular and proper and he has his custom stationery and he has his opulent apartments and... Like, he's so attentive to all the little, you know, there's all these luxurious fabrics and pillows, and he buys Christine all of these shoes and gowns. And
my thought was always that he was stealing the stuff from the productions.
He probably was, but he clearly thinks he has a sense of taste.
Right.
Do you know what I mean?
Like he's got tons of costume jewelry
that
he thinks are like the crown jewels.
Well, maybe he's stolen some from patrons, too.
That's true.
You know, he's phantoming around the opera house. Mm-hmm. But I just think Chaney does such a great job with that and conveying that character every time he's on screen, even when he is being a maniac.
Yeah.
It's really impressive. And I think another actor would maybe not play it that way, where he has these moments of like seeming like he's kind of courteous and very concerned with his clothes. Like before the black tie snorkeling, he takes his cloak off. Mm-hmm. And he like folds it very and like puts it away.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? He doesn't just like drop it or throw it or like,
he
has like a certain like gentleman monster thing going on.
Yeah.
That I think is great because it puts those moments when he is really unhinged into sharp relief. Like when Christine first unmasks him and she ends up on the floor and he kind of dives down at her and he grabs her by the back of the head by the hair and he wrenches her around and it looks like actually painful. Like I looked at it and was like, ooh, that would hurt. That would hurt my neck. But it makes his kind of moments of savagery and like high drama extra, like feel extra big because otherwise he's this kind of like, you know, he's escorting her down the stairs. He's playing the organ.
Yeah. Cause he's, like he's like you're saying, he's covering up for his monstrosity with these airs and yes. these fronts that he's putting up. And so when someone exposes that, it makes him extra mad.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah.
Excuse me. My watching this again, it really, his performance really stood out to me.
Yeah.
And oh, first of all, one of the reasons I believe he was so good as a silent film actor is I believe both of his parents were deaf.
Oh, interesting.
And so he would need to project
and like emote
physically
extra.
And emote,
yeah.
Excuse me. God.
You okay there?
Yeah, my house is trying to kill me.
Good. As a house should.
Yeah. Yeah. But as I was watching it this time, I really was thinking, you know, it's sure they put the money into it, et cetera, et cetera. But the only thing worth watching in this is Chaney.
Yeah.
Like, I don't know. Maybe Mary Philbin was hot stuff back then or something. But I find it to be the only part that really makes the movie that memorable.
Well, because the other characters aren't given much character.
Yeah.
Like the in my opinion, the only other actually interesting character is the secret policeman, Ledoux.
Is that the guy with the fez?
Yes.
Yeah.
And I think half of that is just because he keeps popping up throughout the movie. And you're a little bit like, wait, who the fuck is that guy? What the fuck is that guy doing there?
Am I remembering correctly? I don't remember if this was on Joe Bob or something. Mm. That there was, I don't know if it's in the novel or maybe the original version of the movie, that character has a much larger role.
Oh, maybe.
Where he's like someone who has been like hunting Eric or something like that.
Oh.
And it just got cut down, and so it just turned into like this weird guy standing around with a fez on.
Well, there is at one point a title card where it says, he says, I'm part of the police. Mm-hmm. I've been investigating this. But they you know, they don't give him like a huge, it's pretty much, you know, the old-timey equivalent of a throwaway.
Yeah.
Mine.
Speaking of, so this I do think suffers from the early film hindrance of, well, I mean, I guess it still happens to this day, but it seems, I feel like it's more pronounced back then. Mm. When you're adapting a novel and they just, you got an hour and a half maybe to do it. And so they're just hustling through all this stuff. So they're chopping stuff out. They're cutting, because they've remade this story a billion times.
Yeah.
And watching this one, it's interesting to see how quickly it moves from beat to beat.
Yeah.
So like the beginning, there's no introduction of Chris. Like by when the movie starts, Christine is already being pushed to the front. Like you don't even know who the hell this woman is.
Yeah.
And she's not even on screen yet.
Yep.
And they're already getting like, oh no, the Phantom is saying that Christine has to do this and Carlotta, blah, blah, blah. And all that stuff happens off screen.
Yep.
Whereas usually there's the buildup of the, of the Phantom and
teaching and training her and sort of bringing her to new heights of her talent and skill.
Turning her face away from the garish light of day and all that kind of stuff. But here they're just jumping into it.
Yeah.
And I feel like it really, it seems to be at the service of, let's just do more stuff with Chaney.
Yeah.
And like get to the crazy shit. Because once the crazy shit starts, they kind of throw the plot out the window a bit, and it just turns into, okay, I guess let's have them chase the Phantom now.
Yep.
Which I'm fine with. But,
yeah.
And it does make for a fairly thin movie otherwise.
Yeah, it's tough because, again, we're talking about a silent movie. Mm-hmm. So there's so much of the things we would include in a more modern day adaptation that would build your sense of sympathy towards either Christine or towards the Phantom or towards Raoul or all, you know what I mean? Like all of those sort of establishing, like seeing Christine and Raoul like fall in love and then seeing the Phantom teach Christine so she can be better and then seeing the love triangle play out, like that can be more interestingly done when you can hear it.
Like, yeah.
It's kind of hard to do, like, we're going to do like a vocal training montage, but we can't hear her sing. Like,
well, I mean, they already have one singing sequence in the movie.
But do you know what I mean? Yeah, and and like we've talked about, that's kind of the boringest part of the movie. Like, it has this climactic moment with the chandelier crashing, but for that, like, 5 full minutes of just a lady gesturing on stage with like a hand mirror, it's kind of boring. So I think,
I did find myself thinking, what part of Faust is this?
Yeah. I did too. I'm like, I don't know Faust well enough. So maybe I'm just, I don't know. The extended, and this is obviously an opera version of Faust. So
the extended laundry sequence of Faust.
Yeah, I don't know. But, you know, you're working within the limitations of the genre and the time period.
Yeah.
But it does, for modern audiences, mean that you're kind of dropped in and you're like, all right, Raoul is sort of a nothing guy, mm-hmm. right? Like, he's handsome and I assume he's rich because he's like the Comte de whatever.
Yeah, he's got a fancy coat.
And fancy stationery and a fancy name.
Mm-hmm.
He seems nice. I don't know.
Sure.
He's willing to risk his life to save Christine, so sure.
Which is all you needed to do to be a good guy.
I guess. I have nothing else to go on for Raoul. And Christine, I think, is one of the most difficult characters to like or sympathize with.
I think that's a big part of them cutting so much around in this.
Yes.
Is Christine is a psychopath
right?
in this movie.
And she's like a fickle psychopath, too. Like, she can't make a choice.
I found myself thinking, like, wow, she's just lying to everybody in this.
Yeah.
Because Raoul's like, hey, I love you. And she's like, that's great. I can never see you again.
Yeah.
And he's like, that's just
and
it.
And then she's also like, mwah.
Yeah.
Like, I can never see you again. Let's cuddle. All right, yeah. Bye.
And
wait,
then,
what?
And then Eric's like, you need to come with me. And she's like, okay, master. Definitely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Like, she's down.
Yeah.
Like, when
yeah.
this movie starts, she is down to.
Yes.
For the Faustian bargain.
Yeah. To have a relationship with bad BDSM etiquette with the Phantom.
Yeah. I mean, you know, I think it could have worked with them.
If she wasn't extremely shallow.
That's, yeah.
And I mean, he wasn't a basement-dwelling maniac.
Yeah. Now who's shallow?
I mean, it's not the appearance part. It's the maniac part.
That's true. but yeah, and then after that, like, I don't know why I found myself, this set me off as I was watching it. But when he's like, listen, everything will be fine. You will be a huge star.
Mm.
The only thing I ask you to do, do not touch my mask.
Yeah.
And then she's like, okay.
I know.
Really want to touch that mask.
And it keeps cutting to her face and she has that like expression like, ooh, I'm
yeah.
going to do it. Ooh,
like,
ooh,
you know, if
I'm
he hadn't said anything, I probably wouldn't have even have touched
yeah,
it. But now I have to do it.
I have to.
And then after that, after he, you know, she reveals him and he gets all in her face and I can't remember what he says, but he's basically like, he gives her like another ultimatum, like, you must do this. She's like, okay. And then she leaves and she's like, I'm not going to do any of that.
Right, right, yeah. You stay. He like releases her back into the world. And in exchange, he's saying, you know, I am your one and only.
Yeah.
Like I will let you go. Okay, fine. You want to go? I'll let you go. But you belong to me. You're mine. You can never see Raoul again.
Mm-hmm.
And she immediately is like, dear Raoul,
yes.
please come meet me at the ball, even though I'm not supposed to see you. And also, I will not be alone. So be careful. Anyway, see you there. Bye.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. It. Christine, not as sympathetic in this version as in other versions, I would say.
Yeah. And it makes it really hard because, on the one hand, the Phantom is not being a good boyfriend.
No.
a good wannabe boyfriend.
I would not say so.
But on the other hand, you're sort of like, I don't know, man. Do you have to be like that mean to him?
Yeah. Like, he's got the Lex Luthor in the first Superman movie idea of property value, which it's like, Lex Luthor is like, I have an apartment on Central Park West, but it's 200 feet down. And it's the same thing where he's got a lot of space, but it is in the dungeon.
I mean, I'd live there.
It's not bad. Yeah. Like, honestly, the commute to the surface is probably worse than the commute to work. You know,
I'm literally allergic to the sun. So
there you go.
I take it.
But yeah, he's a really interesting character, too, because, he's killing people. He's that one guy he hangs.
He is also what do they call him? Do they call him the Strangler?
Oh, something like yeah.
Yeah, where it's sort of it's almost like
it implies that he's killed a lot of people.
Right. So they're almost talking about it like it's two different people.
Yeah.
Where they're like the Strangler's noose and like the Strangler is struck again, but then there's also the ghost of the opera.
Yep.
So it's kind of funny that it's like, oh, Nobody's put together that these two might be the same thing until like the end of the movie. It's like, oh shit.
They both buy their stationery at the same store. One says from the desk of Eric, the other says from the desk of Phantom. But yeah, he's like, do you find him to be, I'm not saying he has to be or should be, mm-hmm. but do you find him to be a sympathetic character?
Not really. Mm-hmm. And I'll tell you why. Because I think he's an entertaining character. Mm-hmm. And an interesting character. Like I find the idea of the Phantom really fascinating and fun. Mm-hmm. But this version of him, everything he does is selfish.
Oh yeah.
You know, there's no redeeming moment for him. Mm-hmm. Even his love for Christine is more, it's more about what he thinks he has made her into.
Right.
You know, he thinks he has ownership over her abilities.
Right.
And that he is the reason he's raising her up to aggrandize himself.
Yes.
I don't think it's really like love. You know, like I think if she was a bad singer or she like damaged her vocal cords and could never sing again, I don't think the Phantom would be like, that's okay, I still love you.
Oh yeah, he's kicking her to the curb real fast.
Right.
Carlotta don't look so bad now.
Right, like all of a sudden Mademoiselle Carlotta, who like, what was wrong with her? I don't know. But do you know what I mean? I don't find him sympathetic in that way. Even the little note we get about his background is that he had been
that's my favorite part of the
imprisoned
movie.
On Devil's Isle and then escaped.
Yeah, just says Eric imprisoned in psychopath jail, escaped.
Yes, yes. Like, oh, no, it also says like self-taught musician and something else. I forget.
He reads the card and he's like, "Oh, here's your guy.
Here's your guy." Which again, it's this sort of like fascinating character who's mm-hmm. like fun and interesting, but that I don't think that makes him sympathetic.
Yeah, I think I do think that that stuff and the Fez guy, I think that might be remnants from the book where there's a much longer backstory to Eric.
Yes,
that involves him in like the French Foreign Legion or some shit.
Yeah,
you know, stuff I don't care about.
Who's racist now?
You can't be racist against the French. but yeah, I don't know where I was going with that. That's one of those things I just found so funny that like the condensing, the need to condense things just takes all of this exposition and literally puts it on a 3x5 card. And they're reading them, well, done with that.
Yep.
But yeah, he's not, I find it to be fascinating because there is nothing about Chaney's performance really that makes me think they're going for a sensitive monster here.
Yeah, there's never a moment where he seems like he's on the cusp of kind of trying to change himself or trying to maybe turn over a new leaf or like... Yeah. Entrust himself to the public.
Yeah.
You know?
Or that there's been any sort of history of wrongdoing done against him.
Right.
Like, this is... They start working that shit into the story much later, and I hate that stuff. But, like, this is just like, no, he's a squatter, basically.
Right. He just so happens to look the way he looks. Yeah, he could have looked any way.
Happens to kill people. Right. But we gave him the box number 5, and he's fine. He's fine.
Yeah. It is fascinating though, because I think, you know, the lineage of this story and this movie, similar to something like Dracula or Frankenstein, where once you start looking for it, you can see these types of characters like and types of plots in a lot of different things. And, you know, I've brought up several times when we record the show that I love Brian Fuller's Hannibal.
Mm-hmm.
And I see a lot of this character in the way Mads Mikkelsen plays Hannibal, where it is this sort of, he's fascinating and he's even fun to watch, but he's not really sympathetic. Like, he doesn't think what he's doing is wrong. they don't really get into a whole big sob story backstory for him. It's just like, nah, he's just kind of this way. Like, yeah. He's this like very put together gentleman, but then also he eats people.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's, I mean, similar to Eric, I think the thing that makes Lecter, well, one of the things that makes him so interesting is he doesn't think he's insane.
Right.
You know, that's right. In Manhunter or Red Dragon or whatever, when he's like, how did you do it? How did you catch me? And he's like, well, I had one up on you because you're insane.
Right.
And he's like, what? Shut up.
Yeah. He's like, that's a cop out answer. And it's like, no, that's the real answer.
Right.
But funny enough, I also realized, you know, our last episode was Late Night with the Devil, which is also about Faustian bargains and people kind of being plunged into this other half of showbiz. So I think it's really interesting how much you can trace so many very like different pieces of horror media back into something like this.
Yeah. Where do we go from here? Basement's awesome, coffin bed. So
basement's awesome, coffin bed. Yeah.
His actual makeup is, I mean, we're not saying anything new by saying it's pretty incredible. Chaney is so fascinating because he is someone who, I don't know, seemed to get his kicks off of putting himself through intense pain
in front of others.
Yeah, because he did a couple movies with Todd Browning, who did Dracula and Freaks. He was the first choice to play Dracula, I believe, but then he unfortunately died. He did a movie called The Unholy Three, where he plays someone with two amputated legs at the knees. And of course, what he did was he strapped his legs. He bent his knees and strapped his shins to his thighs.
Oh, my God.
And walked around on his knees or on, like, peg legs, basically.
I think I could do that strapping the legs back for about 3 seconds.
Yeah.
And not putting any weight on it and then being like, no, I'm done.
Yeah.
I'm done. I can't do this. No way.
Yeah. And he just seemed to have an affinity for characters with deformities, disabilities. And, you know, I think it's an interesting part of horror movie history because you are in this arena where, I mean, for as long as people have been around, unfortunately, people who are differently abled or deformed in some way or have something quote unquote wrong with their face are generally seen as scary.
Yeah.
And so you end up in this weird place where these archetypes are now moving into the movies and they are firmly lodged in there. But on top of all of this, you've got so many of the things that he does, especially Phantom, feel reminiscent of battle wounds from the First World War.
Yeah.
The way that even the mask that he wears is very similar to the kind of thing that someone who has like a horrible face wound would wear. And it's, I think the thing that I find so interesting about his makeup is weird enough, but uncanny enough that it doesn't feel like he's picking a certain trait to make scary.
Yes. You know? Yes. Yeah.
It's just such a weird look.
Yeah.
That it doesn't feel like, oh, it's a guy with a scar. Obviously they're bad. You know, it's so I remember the first time I saw it.
Yeah.
Thinking, oh, I guess I wasn't, that's a lot different than I was expecting.
Yeah.
Because I was expecting something like Freddy Krueger, like a really deformed face. And this is just this weird skull like lump of clay kind of.
Yeah, it's not like, oh, he got burned.
Right.
Or oh, he got slashed.
Yeah.
Or oh, this happened to him. Like, no, it's just I don't know. So there's an interesting like quick moment. One of the title cards in this says something about his mastery of black magic.
Oh, that's yeah.
And so there's kind of an implication that he is a magician, right? Like when he lures Christine down into the basement, she seems like she's under a trance.
Yep.
And so there's some kind of thinking out there that it's like, oh, he's been warped by black magic, and that's why he looks this way.
Like the Emperor in Star Wars.
I guess. Yeah. But I kind of don't...
Did he also get blasted in lightning deflection from Mace Windu's lightsaber?
I don't know what, like, half of those words meant.
Yeah, you do. I know who you're married to.
I know what lightsaber means, and I know what lightning and deflection mean separately.
Fair enough.
But the rest of it, I'm very confused.
Anyway.
Anyway. but I don't know if I really like that reading. I kind of like mm-hmm. the reading of he was just born this way. Like, I don't know. People kind of recoil from him, and that sucks. But also, yeah. He doesn't seem like he's really tried very hard to ever get past the first impression that people have of him. Like, he hides his face, and then that's it.
Well, and that's one of the things that I really love about this version of this character is there is no explanation for it.
Right.
Like, in that little card that they have, it doesn't say, escape from prison, fell really hard on his face on a bunch of right. rocks.
Was almost beaten to death. Or was shot in the face in the war. Like, no, right. none of that. None of that. It's just like, I don't know. This is this guy, and this is what he's like.
Yeah, this is the hand he was dealt.
Yep.
And
this is what he's doing with it.
Yeah. yeah. Unfortunately, this is where he is, and this is how he's perceived.
Yeah. but there wasn't, not to crib too much of the Last Drive-In episode, but a lot of that episode, of when they do this movie, they talk about the idea of, or the way audiences at the time reacted to the Phantom. Apparently, now obviously they go way more into detail than I can here, the original ending of this was a redemptive ending for the Phantom.
Mm-hmm.
And people didn't like it.
Mm-hmm.
And they wanted him... They pretty much wanted the ending that they got, which is the Phantom gets killed.
And you just dump his ass into the river.
You just throw him in the river. Without the snorkel, though.
That's true.
But so the implication being that the attractive people deserve to be left to live happily ever after, and the person who looks different should be disposed of and removed from society. And it is, in a modern viewing, in a modern interpretation, a real conundrum to be sort of, like you were saying, when you look at the pattern overall of so many of these early kind of monster movies and monster characters are people with disabilities and physical differences, and what does that pattern say about us? But then on the other hand, in the case of Eric, I'm willing to say all communities have shitty members, right?
Sure. Yeah. Yeah.
I think he's one of them.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's really funny about the ending, because that is definitely what the ending feels like. It's like, okay, well, what if he, I don't know, they chase him down to the river. And then one other guy goes, yeah. And then he reaches into his pocket and he pulls something out. And they go, what does he have? I don't know.
Nothing?
Nothing? Good enough. Yeah. We beat him to death and throw his ass in the river.
Throw him in the river. Well, because doesn't the novel have more of a redemptive ending that, like...
Oh, I don't know. I can't read.
You heard it here first, folks. Literacy is on the decline. I'm pretty sure, I have not read the novel myself, but I'm pretty sure at the end he is sort of redeemed by Christine's purity. You know, like she's a better person in the book, or is portrayed as a better person.
Yeah.
And so her like purity and compassion finally get him to be like, ah, I'm sorry. I fucked up.
I don't care for that.
See, I think that's the general reaction. And so everybody wants him beaten up and thrown in the river.
Well, it's not that so
Rasputin
much. Rasputin
him.
It's not so much that, like, I don't feel like he needs... I think my perfect ending of The Phantom of the Opera is that...
Musical number where they do a big dance together?
Yeah. Is that Eric dies with the opera house burning around him.
Yeah.
That's what feels right to
me. Yeah, or falling on him or something.
Yeah, and like, doesn't need to be a redemptive ending.
Yeah.
It's sort of like a, James Cagney, top of the world mock kind of situation where it's like, yeah, you're there, but you're about to explode and you've been shot 40 times.
Right. Yeah, I can see that more than anything of him... him sort of getting to that ultimate place of, if I can't have it, no one can, mm-hmm. and I'm going to burn the whole thing down. If I'm going down, I'm taking it all with me.
But even, I mean, even in I don't care how the fire starts, but I mean, I've been watching too many Hammer movies. This it should end with the opera house on fire, I think. But yeah, I think his look is so. I remember the first time I saw the face reveal scene, and again being like, that's kind of goofy. Like in my head,
oh, really?
In my head, I had played it out so differently.
Yeah,
where. You know, I think the thing that always caught me off guard was I didn't realize they did it, the thing where she lifts the mask off and you see what he looks like before she does.
Yeah.
I thought there was going to be more of like a reveal or something.
Yeah.
And I always kind of thought that was in the face he makes is a little weird. And I was like, oh, that's kind of goofy. But as I watched more, I was like, man, that's so good.
It's such
like the fact that she lifts the mask off and you know what she's gonna see before she does.
And you get to
incredible.
You get to have your reaction independently of hers and then also enjoy her reaction.
Yeah. And it's such a great way too, without having to push in for a close up, how you can get both of them on the screen and have the face revealed completely unencumbered by anything.
Even like that you get that moment of reveal, and then when it switches kind of to her point of view, the lens is a little foggy.
That's my favorite part.
Yeah, where you can't quite see him, and it's sort of like you're seeing through her eyes, and it's like her brain isn't processing fully what he looks like. Do you know what I mean?
So he
becomes like an abstraction, but he's still getting closer and closer, and then finally it fully clears up and she really sees him.
And 100 years later, when this face has become so ingrained in popular culture as it has, it's different than in 1925 where you're getting that first look, and then the next time you don't even really know what you're looking at, and then the next time they show his face in that sequence, it's all blurred out, so you can't really make out what his face.
Yeah.
It's really smartly done.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's still effective.
I do too, yeah.
I still remember seeing it for the first time and being genuinely like, whoa, what the fuck? You know, like kind of blown away that I didn't understand how they managed to make him look like that.
It really is incredible.
Yeah. And I remember, you know, I don't think it was right after I'd seen this for the first time, but I remember at some point finally seeing a picture of like normal ass Lon Chaney next to this and
dude,
being
looks
like
my grandfather.
But the fact that that guy is that guy is really impressive.
Yeah. Like I've never really been that impressed with the Quasimodo makeup.
Yeah.
It's just kind of like it's just got a bunch of shit on him.
Yeah.
You know, and a weird eye and a hump. But this one is like, if this is like a Max Schreck level makeup, where if I didn't know Lon Chaney was the person playing this guy, I would just assume this is what the actor looked like.
I thought the first time I saw it, I was like, well, obviously he doesn't look like that, but I kind of thought he'd look closer to that.
Yeah.
And then I remember finally seeing him being like, oh, wait, this is really quite a transformation.
Before we started recording, we were talking a little bit, and I was saying, we were looking at a picture of the Phantom, and I was saying how I've never liked his hair.
Yeah,
because his hair, it's just, I don't know, it's a weird choice, because it's like the back of his head is bald. He's just got this like these two little flaps, but as we've kind of been talking about it, I think I'm coming around to this idea that he still parts his hair in the middle as though he had a full head of hair to style.
Again, he's vain.
Yeah.
It's like the central characteristic of this character is that he's really vain. It's sort of like the stereotype we have now of balding men who do comb overs to try and hide it. And it's not really hiding it from anybody, but
it's a power move, man. You get elected president with that hair.
But it's the idea of not wanting to kind of face up to the reality of like, okay, this is how I look, this is what I'm dealing with. It's this idea that if he tries hard enough to cover it up with all of these extra trappings, that he'll somehow pass mm-hmm. as a different type of person. And I think, you know, when we had been having that off mic conversation about his hair, I kind of asked you, like, well, how else do you think it should look? And you were like, I don't know, maybe coming down from the sides or like something. And I was kind of considering that question myself, like what other hairstyles would make sense? And I don't think many would, because I think he would keep it neat.
Yeah.
You know, he seems like very fastidious in his appearance. And so the answer seems to be whatever hair he had would be like aggressive. Yeah, it would be aggressively flattened yeah. to his head.
It does remind me a bit of the Eggers Nosferatu.
Yeah.
Where he's got that just that uh-huh. one shock of hair.
I was going to ask you, do you think this is prime for an Eggers version of
yeah.
Phantom of the Opera?
Yeah, he's just
amazing.
He's running the table, right? He's got the werewolf coming out.
I actually really hope he does. I hope he does a non-musical version of Phantom of the Opera.
Well, I was going to say, if he can find a non-licensed version, because yeah. he seems to be just picking the monsters yeah, and yeah, not yeah. the books yeah, they're yeah, based yeah. off of.
Theater Ghost.
Yeah, that would be pretty cool. Mm.
That would be amazing.
I do remember when I finally watched the musical movie.
Mm-hmm.
I was like, oh, this is whatever.
I don't think I've ever watched the full thing.
It's
I think I've just watched sort of the highlight reel.
I just remember the casting being really weird.
Mm-hmm.
Gerard Butler.
Yeah.
Not famously known
yeah.
as a singer.
Yeah.
Okay. But I do remember there was a handful of sequences in it where I was like, man, this was before Chris Nolan took over Batman.
Mm.
And I found myself thinking, like, oh, wow, that's pretty cool. The guy who did this could probably do a pretty good Batman.
Mm.
Forgetting the director of that movie was Joel Schumacher,
mm.
who did, in fact, do two Batman.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Killed the franchise.
Seems like he'd actually be a better choice for a musical adaptation of Phantom of the Opera.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, honestly, he should have done it like he did the Batman movies. A lot more
yeah.
neon. That'd been cool.
Yeah, actually.
The masquerade sequence.
Yes, love it.
Very cool. It is in, I mean, quote unquote, full color.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's two strip Technicolor,
mm.
which, not to get too deep into the weeds here,
as
I think I've done previously. before we get to that, have I already mentioned at some point my theory about why young people from 40 years ago look older than the same age they would be today? Does that make sense? Like a 35-year-old
yeah.
from now looks younger than they did 40 years ago.
I understand what you're saying. I just don't remember if you've expressed your theory.
No. I have two theories.
Lead.
Yeah. Three theories. One, mustaches. Mustaches are making a comeback, so
uh-huh.
that maybe that's going to even the playing field. But two, uh-huh. this is the big one. I don't think men specifically go bald the same way they used to. You'd never see a young guy with Kelsey Grammer hair. Kelsey Grammer or Doc Brown hair or
uh-huh.
Jean-Luc Picard hair or even Jason Alexander hair. It's always once guys start going bald, immediately they buzz it.
Yeah, yeah.
You never have that awkward phase anymore, probably because they've seen what these people look
yeah,
like.
Yeah, I think that's...
But it's one of those things where it's like, I don't know, you look at a guy who's 25 from
yeah.
1982
yeah.
who's got like... no hair on the back, but then it's like long, like the Hulk Hogan
yeah.
look. And it's
yeah.
like, yeah, he looks like he's 45.
I think some of it's also just our own personal perceptions
yeah.
of like what you were a kid and you'd look at Hulk Hogan and be like, ah, yes, a full adult.
Yeah, I still remember the first time that I realized professional athletes
mm-hmm.
were all like
yeah.
in their early 20s.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was specifically when the Red Sox were mm-hmm. making their big first
mm-hmm.
World Series push.
Yeah.
And they all started growing beards.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, that's...
Only half of them couldn't do it.
Well, no, they were growing these beards, and yeah. I was like, huh. I remember baseball players in the 80s
uh-huh.
all having mustaches,
yep.
and I assumed they were like in their 40s.
No.
And I was thinking the same thing, like all of these guys, because I found myself thinking like,
I see what's going on.
Look at all these young guys growing mm-hmm. these big, stupid beards.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh my God, they're all children.
And they were back then,
and
too.
And they were back then, too.
Yep.
Cigarettes. That's also another
yes,
reason.
Yes, that was going to be my thing.
Everything was caked in a
yeah, yeah,
layer
yeah.
of cigarette
yeah,
smoke.
And lead.
I Could you imagine what it must have been like when everything smelled like a bowling alley? Like every
sweat,
single
stale beer and cigarettes.
Every single room you went into, whether it was a public space or a house, a relative's house, a friend's house, everything smelled like cigarettes.
Yep. As someone who grew up in a household with a smoker, I can indeed imagine that.
Did you get immune to it?
Yeah. I mean, my dad quit smoking when I was like 12. So for the first like 12 years of my life, it was just sort of, I don't know, you know, you don't, especially when you're a kid, I feel like you don't notice the smell of your own house.
That's true.
You're just sort of like, yeah, whatever.
Yeah.
And when we'd go to places, like my dad didn't really smoke indoors, but it also meant that like, we didn't really care. Like, you know, when there were still smoking sections.
Sure.
It was just like, yeah, all right, if we're near the smoking section, whatever.
Isn't it insane that you used to be able to smoke on a plane?
That regularly blows my mind.
It's absolutely nuts.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Old person corner is over now.
We looked at this house one time.
Yeah.
It's a pretty big house. Decent price. We as soon as you walked in, it was like a quick jab to the nose with stale cigarette smell. And like every single room smelled like cigarettes, and it was like thick old carpet. And I was like, okay, let's see what the upstairs is like. It was like you passed through a plane where it was like kind of smelled like smoke to where the smokers lived.
Right.
Oh my God. It was.
You thought when you walked downstairs, oh, a smoker used to live in here. And then you walk upstairs and you're like, oh no, a smoker used to live in here.
Yeah, the whole house was filled with smokers.
Yeah.
And we were kind of kidding. We were like, I don't know. It's a lot of space. And like you can clean that, right? And my girlfriend was a bit more optimistic about it than I was. And my point of view was like, listen, even if we only got 98% of the smell out, it would still be awful.
Mm-hmm.
So we didn't buy that house.
That's I think a decision for the best.
Yeah. Anyway, Masquerade Ball.
Yes.
Two strip Technicolor. Basically, the original Technicolor, as it's traditionally known, I believe, is a three-step coloring process. So it's basically the same way that digital stuff works, where it's red, green, and blue.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you put those three together in different varieties, you get full color. The early version of that was two-strip, which I believe was just red and blue. If you watch the coloring in the movie, it just it looks like it's just two colors kind of fighting for space.
Yeah, transitioning from one end of that specific color's spectrum to the other.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But yeah, I have to imagine at the time that was probably pretty incredible.
Yeah.
Going to see that movie and then boom.
This is one of those movies that makes me feel like in general, when I watch it, funny enough, especially the beginning when you first see all the people going into the opera house and then you see everybody sitting and you see the orchestra and you see the ballerinas come out and start performing. Every time I see that opening sequence, I'm kind of like, man, when this came out, watching this movie must have felt astounding. To see this many people on film moving around, like sure. just the way it all is shot, it's like really kind of drives home to me the idea that like seeing like in 1925, seeing this many people and things portrayed in this realistic way on film moving around in front of you still felt like fresh and new and exciting. That's how this movie always makes me feel, is like, oh yeah, this must have been such a spectacle.
Yeah, I love that in old movies, the best special effect you could have is we somehow managed to get 500 people to show up.
Yeah. And you're just shooting them all like it's an actual theater. Yeah. And it's kind of like, yeah, in 1925, for a lot of people, this probably felt like overwhelming.
Yeah.
You know, it's kind of cool to think about.
Yeah. I wish there's a lot, not to firmly plant myself in old man corner, but I think there's so much of this stuff that is
pitching
that
a tent over there.
Whoa. Excuse me.
I mean, literal tent.
You know how much I love extras. There's just, I wish there was a little bit more tactileness, tacticity. Is that a word? I wish films were a bit more tactile
sure.
in what they're actually showing you.
Mm.
And I mean, it's just so easy to copy and paste crowds and stuff. And,
mm-hmm.
you know, when you get a movie where it's clear that they got together 300, 400 people for yeah. a scene of extras and whatnot. Yeah. I don't know. I think it's the little things like that that really go a long way.
Get ready to never see that again once everything becomes AI.
Ugh. Ugh. I gotta admit, though, it's really cool. I ethically don't like it, but...
What, AI?
Yeah. It's really cool.
Is it cool?
I think it's very cool. Like, the fact that... The stuff that you can do with it is very impressive.
Sure.
But it's only used for the stupidest shit.
That's why I don't think it's cool.
Yeah.
Like, I don't know.
I guess... When I say it's cool,
I'm moving into old man corner.
When I say it's cool, I guess what I mean is, like... The technological capability to yeah. render the image that it is rendering,
yeah.
I find very impressive. However, I don't like it as a thing.
Yeah.
You know? Like, as much as I like the Instagram account that is just Macho Man Randy Savage and Mr. Rogers hanging out together, which is excellent.
Sure.
Could the world do without that? Yeah.
Yeah.
Probably.
Yeah. Could somebody with a talent for Photoshop... or art in other ways, put that together, look, make it look pretty good? Probably yeah.
Yeah. It's pretty good, though.
Fair enough.
Recommend it.
Fair enough.
What are we talking about? Oh, yeah. Masquerade. I'm a little bit surprised, or maybe... how do I drop into this? Mm. One of the things I was thinking was, I kind of feel like if you did this movie now, the move that would be on the table to make would be at the masquerade ball, Eric shows up in full regalia with no mask.
And everybody's like, wow, what an amazing mask.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Or it's like, that's the moment he feels like he can be, he's the king of the monsters, basically.
Yeah, yeah.
Do you like that he shows up in this full skull mask and everything?
Do you think
that is in line with his vanity?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think that, you know, if we're talking about the time period in which this movie was made and seems to be taking place, I think no one would have even seen a costume mask to the extent of his face.
Mm-hmm.
And so it still would have freaked people out and drawn attention in a way he would not have liked. I think him taking the opportunity to come in and bring some drama is how he would do it, but he's doing it very much on his own terms, where it's one thing if he wears this giant skull mask and people recoil from it like they're scared. That, I think, gives him a sense of power. Mm. If it was his real face, it's a sense of humiliation.
That's true.
And that seems to be the thing that really sets him off, is this, like, feeling of being rejected for his actual appearance.
Mm.
Whereas getting to come in and reference an Edgar Allan Poe story and kind of stake his claim on the space, where he sort of shames everybody. He says, you're dancing above the rooms that people were kept and tortured. And I, you know, he says something about, you know,
He does a land acknowledgement before the party.
Kind of, yeah. And kind of like tells everyone you should be ashamed of yourselves.
Yeah.
Like, it's his opportunity to try and turn that concept of shame back on other people.
Yeah.
But still very much get attention in a way that makes him feel powerful rather than belittled.
Yeah. I find that move from him where he's, you know, playing the Edgar Allan Poe card and kind of shaming them.
Mm-hmm.
I find that interesting because he doesn't have any connection to that stuff, right?
To what stuff?
To the torture chambers. Like, he was, we're not given any, I guess.
Yeah.
when I facetiously say land acknowledgement, yeah, it kind of feels like that same thing where it's like, well, you know.
I can't remember if I read this or if it's like very lightly implied in the movie itself, but I think it's supposed to be that he was one of the people tortured in one of these rooms, like post some sort of uprising or something, and that's why he's attached to it the way he is. I don't even think you necessarily need that in this movie, though.
Sure.
I think it's the fact that he feels like the opera is his temple. Mm-hmm. It's his church. It's his place of power and worship. And these kind of... This ball, one of the things it does say is that it's when all of Paris comes together. And that seems to imply, and I think the visuals imply, that it crosses class lines as well.
Yeah.
So you have the sort of upper crust people, you know, doing their ball. And then in some of the lower floors and other like side rooms, you get the stagehands and the ballerinas who are essentially like working class people kind of cavorting and doing inappropriate dances and playing pranks on each other. And I think for him, he thinks they're belittling the sanctity of the opera house, too. Mm. I think that is like part of it, because I think, again, like the way he feels like he owns Christine, he feels like he owns the whole opera.
Right, yeah.
So
did you tour the opera house when you went to Vienna?
I did not, but I did go to the Seegrat outside of Vienna, which is an underground lake.
Oh,
and I got to ride around in a boat in an old gypsum mine that's now an underground lake.
I missed that one.
So I got the Phantom version of this tour, not the Christine version.
Well, the reason I ask is because, I mean... I guess I assume they probably do this at all major opera houses, but they basically do this at the Vienna Opera House, where once a year they will have different balls there throughout the year, but they will have one massive ball, which is kind of like the one everybody goes to.
Yeah.
And they like take the seats out and stuff and turn the entire seated area into like a giant ballroom.
That's awesome.
Yeah, it's very cool. And it's one of those things where it's like the very rich will be there, but also you can just go as a person and it was very cool.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that's what the masquerade ball in this is. And I think this is kind of the Phantom displaying his snobbery, you know,
he thinks
of himself as not only high class, but even above those people.
Mm-hmm.
And so all of this is very beneath him.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Speaking of AI.
Yes.
The scene when they are on the roof.
AI.
Yeah, actually, yes. No, it's completely. So they change the coloring there. So they go back to like the blue tint for the nighttime.
Mm-hmm.
But his cloak is still colored red.
Yeah, it looks amazing.
And the only thing I could think as I was watching that is like I'm imagining the poor fucking low paid Universal Studios.
Yeah.
Film, what's the word I'm looking for? Slave, basically.
Yeah.
Who's hand painting each one of these friggin' frames of this stupid thing, which it looks like they're trying to color it in like in real time.
Yeah.
And all I could think was, you can do that with like a fucking Instagram filter now.
Yep.
This thing that probably crippled that guy's hand.
Yep. Yep. But it still looks great.
It does. It looks very cool. And I do really like that scene of jealous Phantom eavesdropping on the two of them.
It's having like a very dramatic windswept moment while the two of them are just kind of standing next to each other being like, you're cute.
It is like, it is the perfect emo teenager moment.
Yes.
Because I feel like anytime you've had a crush on someone and you see that person across the room talking to someone else that is not you.
Yes. And who you think is maybe better than you.
Yeah.
In some
or worse.
Right. But there's like with the Phantom, at least, there's definitely a jealousy
aspect. Yeah.
Yeah.
I feel like we are all Eric in that moment where you.
Yeah.
You're just looking at these two people talking casually and you're like, no. Yeah. I will burn the place to the ground.
How do you feel about the sort of climactic lead up with Raoul and Ledoux in the basement?
The Punjab lasso sequence where they're walking around like tarantella dancers.
That, but then also afterwards where it's like, I'm going to make them really hot until they die.
Yeah.
I'm going to drop them into the secret gunpowder room and I'm going to flood it until they die.
So one of the things I think is very impressive about this movie is are the sets.
Yes.
And every time they go into a different room, mm-hmm. whether it's below the opera house or somewhere backstage, mm-hmm. set design is incredible.
Yes.
And they really pull out some weird shit. Like there's that one thing that's like a giant dragon mouth.
Yeah, I love that. I love that.
This is all of a roundabout way of me saying I feel like this stuff is a little lazy.
Yeah.
It's just...
It also just doesn't feel like it... It just feels like they're throwing so much into the Phantom where it's kind of like, he's a musician and a composer and this sort of self-taught genius. And he's also a lover of all arts and whatever. But he's also a strangler. And he's also got like a specially built sauna room to murder dudes in, and he's also got a snorkel, and he's also got so it just starts to feel a little bit
he
late.
Turns into like okay. a Batman villain basically.
Yeah, it kind of does.
Do you like that whole final climactic sequence, or how do you feel about it?
Not really. It's kind of weird. Like I don't necessarily dislike each individual piece. I think it's the sum of all of it together starts to feel a little like, okay, all right. It feels a little bit like, you know, when a kid tells you a story and it's a little bit like, we went to the park and then there was like the biggest spider anyone had ever seen.
Yep.
And then I went and got everybody and I made them come look at the spider. And then there was also a snake. Mm-hmm. And then there was also a big cat coming behind the snake. And then the snake was getting close to the spider. And then, and you're like, okay, all right, great, cool. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay, got it, buddy. Like it felt a little bit like that. Like they had to just kind of keep escalating a little bit to try and inject some sort of tension.
Yeah, I mean, that's, you know, you're getting into the end of this thing. How are you going to wrap this up?
Yeah.
You know.
But I part of it, I felt a little bit like, because the mob is building in a separate area.
Right, yeah.
You know, and they're building because Eric made the sort of mistake of killing this one dude's brother.
Yeah.
That seems to be the whole trigger for the mob.
That's the guy who they find hanged, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Who I think is supposed to have been the guy at the beginning with the head.
Yeah.
AKA my favorite character in this movie. But yeah, it's so fascinating to me that it really is like he kind of made this unforced error, right?
Counts, by the way. Mannequin head.
Ah, all right, fair enough. Ending the year on the right note.
Sure.
But I don't know. I find that really interesting that it really is just this one murder that tips the sort of everyman characters into like, nope, it's mob time. It's mob justice time. And then the confrontation between him and the mob is actually very short.
Yeah.
He does his psych out with the hand with fake hand grenade, and then
the thing I
they
do
grab him, and that's kind of it.
The thing I do like about the fake hand grenade moment is,
I know you love the fake hand grenade moment.
Is he does go out very theatrically.
Yes.
Like that's the big move, is he, you know, I've got the weapon.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
He's like, ah, I forgot.
Or
my lines.
black magic is going to get you.
Right,
and then
it's,
and then he kind of laughs at them as they tackle him.
You know, I think generally the problem I've always had with Phantom of the Opera, mm-hmm. and I think one of the reasons I really like the Robert Englund version is I haven't read the book. Mm. I don't know how he's played in the book.
Sure.
But I feel like it's never really clear what this guy's deal is supposed to be. I don't mean like a backstory thing.
Yeah, like what's his goal?
Yeah. Is he someone who's committed a bunch of murders?
Mm-hmm.
But if that's the case and they think he's living in the opera house, why don't they do more to find this guy?
Right. That's what I mean by like, it seems like this one murder somehow tipped things into a mob when it's known that there's the strangler around.
Right. Yeah. But also maybe he's a ghost.
Right.
Or they think he's a ghost, but people are still dying.
That's why I was confused about like throughout the movie, do they think that the strangler and the Phantom are the same person?
Yeah.
Or do they think they're separate? And I know some people might be like, it doesn't matter, but I think it matters for the end.
Yeah.
Because if they think it's the same person and he's been strangling people, why is it that strangling this one guy is when everybody went, he killed Joseph. That's it. We can't do this anymore. Killing Betty, Tom, Fred, mm-hmm. and whoever was fine. But mm-hmm. Joseph is a step too far.
He was a nice guy.
Did you carry that head around with him all the time?
Yeah. He's always telling stories. Yeah. And I think once you start throwing the love story thing they try to do, that gets a little muddy for me because it's like, I think the one thing I do like about Christine in this version that I don't feel like comes through in a lot of other versions when they try to do this stuff is Christine generally doesn't have any agency over what she's doing.
Yeah.
In this one, she seems to be down to clown. Until he takes the mask off.
Yeah, I mean, I think she definitely regrets her decisions,
but
she has made decisions to regret.
Yeah, and the other ones, it's always like, you will be the singer, and she's like, oh, okay.
Yeah.
And I generally feel like it doesn't have that Faustian element to it where she's okay.
Yeah, I mean,
sure.
Yeah, if you're going to help me topple Mademoiselle Carlotta so I can take her part, let's fucking go. Let's do it.
And so you end up with this weird kind of muddled love story thing where it's like you're supposed to want her to be with the Phantom or something, and
but I think you're not. I think in this version you're really supposed to.
No, in this version you're not. Definitely not. But I feel like it has the same problem Dracula ends up developing.
Yes.
Where it's like, well, he's the lead, so he must be sexy and must be desirable.
Right. It's there must be something magnetic about him that these women are gonna fall for.
I don't know. Maybe he sucks.
Yeah.
And he's a monster.
Yeah. Yeah, maybe he's just found somebody to prey upon and he's going to like quietly or loudly ruin their life.
I mean, by the time you get to the play, it's just like a quarter mask.
Usually
played by a very attractive
man. It's a very handsome dude who just happens to have some like burn marks on one side of his face.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Disappointing.
Agreed.
Robert Englund one though. Can't wait. Did I already tell you what his mask is in that movie?
Oh, you might have, but I don't remember.
Oh, it's incredible. He cuts off people's faces
and builds
his mask out of other people's faces.
Okay.
It's awesome.
All right. Okay. I am now intrigued.
Oh, it's so good. It's like it's just like it's the Splatterhouse version of Phantom of the Opera. It's fucking great. Okay. I love it. Anyway.
All right.
Anything you want to talk about before we wrap up?
I did just want to mention that I know the soundtrack on this, at least the version we watched, is kind of disappointing.
Mm-hmm.
But I do like the parts where they're almost using the like creak of the ropes and pulleys backstage and underground to like augment the soundtrack.
Yeah.
I liked those parts. I thought they were like,
I think,
creepy and atmospheric.
That's what I mean when I say it's not the notes that are being played.
Mm-hmm.
Like if they played this soundtrack
with
like an orchestra,
I
think I'd be fine with it.
Yeah.
It's just that cheap synthesizer
Casio keyboard in somebody's basement.
Yeah.
Yeah. Fair enough.
This is number 93 on our list.
Mm-hmm.
How do you feel about the placement? Higher, lower? Take it off completely?
I think it should be higher on the list. I think it should be closer to 50.
Yeah.
I mean, it's the Phantom of the Opera, right?
It's
kind of kicked off its own like micro economy with adaptations and musicals and adaptations of the musical. And everybody knows if you saw that outfit, you know, whether it's not the Lon Chaney outfit, but if you saw the sort of now what we think of as the classic Phantom of the Opera with that half white mask, everybody knows what that is. It's so ubiquitous.
I do also remember when I first saw this, when I saw his mask, I was like, what the fuck is that thing? Because I you're just so used to the mask being like a cool white mask.
Yeah, that's sort of, it looks like a piece of the drama and comedy, tragedy and comedy masks.
Yeah, something like that.
Yeah.
But in this, it's like this weird derpy, I think it works better for the time because it does have that almost prosthetic face look to it.
Yeah, I also love that he has a mouth veil.
Yes.
Where if you look close enough, you can see his like gnarly teeth behind
it. Oh, really?
It.
I didn't notice that. Yeah. I guess I was just, again, I was expecting more, I guess I was expecting something more modern, which I shouldn't have.
Yeah.
But
but fair enough. It's very, to our kind of modern eyes, it's a very unusual looking mask.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I do have history with the Phantom of the Opera.
Oh. You guys get in a bar fight or something?
We were roommates in college.
No. When he escaped from Devil's Isle, yes. He didn't take you with him?
No. When I was a kid, my aunt used to babysit me while my mother was working, and she had three older cousins, mm-hmm. and I used to hang out with them all the time. Mm-hmm. And I remember like very clearly the toys that they had because they were like just too old for me.
Yeah.
Which meant that I really wanted
Yeah. That means they're the best toys you've ever seen.
And one of the things that scarred me for a long time is one of my cousins, I can't remember which one, mm-hmm. had this, I assume it was just a Halloween mask, mm-hmm. but it was a Phantom of the Opera mask. Mm-hmm. So it was the white mask,
yeah.
but it was two pieces. So you could pull the mask off, and underneath it was the scarred face.
Oh, cool.
And I remember he did one, whichever one it was, he did that to me.
Oh, man.
And scared the shit out of
me. That's amazing.
Yeah.
I understand now why you have strong opinions about masks that maniacs wear in horror movies.
Yeah. You know, that's probably where it comes from.
That's probably where it comes from.
Yeah, I would put it higher, I think.
Yeah.
I'm always impressed by when a monster can, without having to come back a bunch of times, mm-hmm. can make the impression like visually.
Yeah.
Like I said, they've made this movie 1,000 times.
Mm-hmm.
There has not been another iconic Phantom
right.
until the play.
Right.
And that's just the mask.
Exactly.
Like, it's just the shape of the mask.
Yeah, completely. The face beneath it doesn't matter at all, really.
Any other time you watch this, a different version, it's just like, they just don't get the mask right.
Right.
They don't get the face right.
Right. It's some otherwise good-looking guy with just like some gloop on one half of his face.
Even that is... Sometimes they try too hard and mm-hmm. it's like the mask is too much. The face is too much.
Yeah. Yeah.
Whatever it is. Chaney just,
I think because it was his real face, right? Like it was augmented with other things that he did to it. And I know he wore like a skull cap to like change his hairline and mm-hmm. stuff. But other than that, it was his face.
Yeah.
You know, it wasn't a bunch of prosthetics layered on. There was no airbrushing or special effects to it. It was his face.
Yeah, I think he literally had his nose pulled back by like fishing wire or something.
Oh my god, that sounds so painful.
Yeah, he was an interesting guy. Not a great dad, I don't think.
Oh, that's yeah.
And if he was, I'm sorry, I apologize.
Yeah. apologies to the Chaney family.
Chaney family. I think that's gonna do it for Phantom of the Opera. And we have one more episode before the end of the year, which is going to be our coverage of the 2019 remake of Black Christmas to coincide with the final episode of our Patreon series on reboots and remakes.
It is the season for reboots and rebates.
Yes.
Yeah.
Where we will be doing Black Xmas from it's the first sign that it's not going to go great.
Ugh.
From 2009, I believe it is. We are going to do Amanda and I are going to record the Black Xmas first.
Okay.
Because I want to have both prior versions in the hopper for when we talk about the newest one.
Got it.
So we'll probably have that up on Patreon before the final main feed episode comes out. So hopefully everybody will be on the same page when we talk about Black Christmas. I'm looking forward and not looking forward to watching this movie again because I disliked it so much at the time.
Yeah.
I want to see if I can
Be
a little bit more objective about it.
Fair, yeah. Yeah.
But we'll see.
I am both also excited and not excited.
Part of me feels like you're going to come away going like, that was actually pretty good because I talk so much shit about it.
I don't know, man. There have been other movies where you kind of were like, I don't know, it's not bad. And then like the remake of, was it like Texas Chainsaw or something?
Yeah.
Like, oof. It was a rough one.
Well, that's the opposite of what I'm saying, but I understand what you're
saying.
I know,
but you know what I mean? It's all that error.
Yeah.
Error. I don't know what I'm saying. I need to go.
Yeah, I think we're done here. If you guys want to help support the show, head over to patreon.com/thepenskyfile and get in on the reboot and remake train. Thank you guys for listening. Thank you for supporting the show. Thank you, Amanda.
Thanks, Clay.
We'll see you next time.
Bye, everyone.